Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support for The Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. We're beginning today's morning show here on WGTD with a conversation about blood donation and what a critical difference it makes when most of us do our civic duty, to donate blood. It can be a matter of life and death, of course. And I'm very, very excited to be able to speak for the next few minutes with Linda Gruber, who is Director of Donor Services the Blood Center of Wisconsin. They have 10 locations scattered across the state, although especially concentrated here in this corner of the state with locations in Kenosha and Racine and throughout the metropolitan Milwaukee area and other points beyond. And Linda Gruber joins me to talk for a few moments about the work of the Blood Center of Wisconsin. And we're going to be talking about what people should think about if they are thinking about donating, the way in which this important matter is handled, and the kind of difference that this really makes. Linda Gruber, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg. I'm very excited to talk about blood donation and how critical it is for us to step up and, you know, do our civic duty and help our patients in our local hospitals.
Tell us, first of all, how crowded a landscape are we talking about in terms of the whole kind of business of blood donation? I don't mean to frame it in kind of crass commercial terms, but I think some people don't maybe fully understand just where this can occur and under whose regulation and who is kind of coordinating all of these various efforts. Help us understand where the Blood Center of Wisconsin kind of fits into the overall framework.
So Blood Center of Wisconsin is an independent blood center. And there are, you know, I think there are national blood centers that people recognize those overall names. But within the state of Wisconsin, we do have several independent blood centers. And our responsibility has grown from, like you had talked about, kind of the corner of southeastern Wisconsin to providing blood products for patients in our hospitals throughout the state. And at this point in time, we provide products to about 55 hospitals in Wisconsin. We are regulated by the Food and Drug Administration, so they have rules and guidelines that we have to follow. We also have accreditations from the American Association of Blood Banks, which call themselves now AABB. And then from there down, there's many other accrediting and licensing agencies that we have to follow rules and regulations from. So it's a highly regulated industry in order to make sure that the blood that we collect and supply to our patients is safe.
Right. How much blood typically is collected through the Blood Center of Wisconsin? And how much does that vary through the course of, for instance, a calendar year? I mean, are there seasons where blood donation is in a sense, much more plentiful or numerous versus other times of the year when in a sense, the need becomes much more acute?
That is a great question. So throughout the year, we do, you know, you do have areas of higher ability for donors to be able to donate. So I would say in the spring of the year, when the high schoolers are running their blood drives and they are a good percentage of them eligible to donate, when you're looking at March and April and May and those high schools are doing that, we have a great access to blood donors. And that helps us tremendously. Every single day, we need to collect between 800 and 900 units of blood. So throughout the year, you're talking about 175,000 units of blood that need to be collected, and that's just red cells, and that's not talking about some of the other products that our donors donate. So we probably struggle more in our summer months because of the fact that people are on vacation. They have a lot of things going on. They, you know, they still come in to donate, but it's more difficult to get that time scheduled.
When blood is taken, what happens to it? Can you help us understand kind of the timeline? And how long does the blood stay at the Blood Center of Wisconsin? What do you do with it once it is collected versus once it is dispersed?
So from the time that the blood is collected, so the donor comes in and donates, and they're donating a whole blood unit of blood. So that's the main kind of line of, you know, of the blood coming through the process. So it all comes down to our headquarters location in Milwaukee, and it goes through a process of testing. We separate that blood into components. So we separate the red cells into its own component for transfusion, and we also then separate the plasma into its own component. So that takes about a day between the testing and the separation, and then it needs to be labeled and on the shelf. So it takes about a day and a half to come from the time that the donor comes in the door to when that blood is on the shelf and it is ready for our patient to use. The amount of time that we have that blood on our shelf can vary, but most of those units are actually moved out within 3 to 5 days.
And generally speaking, is the blood being given to the same places? I mean, is it traveling pretty much the same routes again and again and again, or does that vary as well in terms of where the blood that is collected ultimately ends up?
It travels the same routes. You know, if you think about the usage in the community, when you're talking about our large community our large community hospitals, you know, they're going to be the ones that are going to be using the most blood for their patients. So those routes are pretty set.
So describe what a typical visit to the Blood Center of Wisconsin is like. And I should hasten to add that I suspect that public radio listeners are pretty diligent and dutiful when it comes to something as important as donating blood. But I suspect there are listeners who, for one reason or another, have actually never had the opportunity or taken the opportunity to donate blood. What is a typical visit for a donor like?
Mm-hmm. So the visit usually takes about 45 minutes to an hour. And what happens is when you come in and you're greeted, the first thing that the staff at the blood center will do or at the drive, they'll take you into an area that's private, and they will go through a series of questions that they will ask you, some of your basic health history type questions, and then they'll ask you questions about things that might, you know, affect the safety of the blood for the patient, and they're going to make sure that you are healthy to be able to donate. They're going to do a mini physical, which is a blood pressure, temperature, and a pulse. And then the piece that a lot of our donors say they dislike the most is they're going to do a finger stick, and they're going to measure your red blood cell count. So that's probably for most donors that have donated with us before, that, you know, that's an area that they're very familiar with. As you finish up that piece of it, then you were escorted into the area where the blood donation actually takes place. You get to sit in a nice lounge chair and kind of sit back and put your feet up and relax and have a good conversation with the staff. And the blood donation itself really is about an 8 to 10 minute process.
Typically, is it important for people to have done something ahead of their visit? That is, does it matter if they have been very physically active or not active at all, or if they have eaten or not eaten? Does it matter very much what somebody has done in the 12 hours before they come to the blood center?
Well, it sounds like you are very familiar with blood donation. So we really want our donors to make sure that they are drinking a lot of fluids. You want to be hydrated. especially in the summer months. I think that's very important. Sometimes we forget. You want to make sure that you are very well hydrated, and you want to follow your normal pattern. So if you are a breakfast eater, you want to make sure that you're getting up and you're having your breakfast, you're having your lunch. What you want to do is try to avoid kind of rushing into to come in to donate. You want to just follow your normal pattern before you come in within that 12 hours. For some of our repeat donors, they have a very specific process that they go through before they come in. But for the population that has not donated before, those are probably the first two key things that you want to think about. You want to make sure that you've gotten a good night's sleep, you're well hydrated, and then that third being that that you're not coming on an empty stomach or waiting to have lunch afterwards, that you want to make sure that you've had a meal beforehand.
You mentioned the red blood count as being an important factor, and that mm-hmm. someone might actually end up not being able to donate if that, I assume the issue would be if the red blood count was too low. What are the kind of conditions that would lead to that?
Well, it's very dependent on, number one, on your gender. So women that are in that childbearing age, just by normal patterns of behavior, may have a little bit lower blood count, and that's normal for them, and it's not of any health concern for them. Men normally are a little bit higher, so that doesn't seem to be as much of an issue for them. But it really is the sometimes, like I said, again, it's gender-related. And you just want to make sure especially for donors that donate more frequently, that, we see them a couple of times a year, that you are maybe taking a multivitamin that has a little extra iron in it. Those kinds of things will help before you come in. But that's kind of what predisposes somebody to have a low iron, is really kind of the, again, women in that childbearing age. And then if you're dieting along those lines, but that's unusual.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today with Linda Gruber, Director of Donor Services for the Blood Center of Wisconsin. She is one of the coordinators for the 10 locations of the Blood Center of Wisconsin, located all over the state of Wisconsin, although most of their sites are in southeastern Wisconsin, but they have locations as far afield as La Crosse and Marshfield. Linda Gruber, we probably should talk about the portion of the population that should consider themselves eligible to donate blood. And a number of different issues, of course, can arise. And one of them is probably age. Is there a official cutoff point mm-hmm. past which somebody is considered to be too old to donate blood? And maybe we should talk about the other end of the age range as well. Is there a point where you are too young to donate mm-hmm. blood?
So in the state of Wisconsin, the state does allow a donor that is 16 years of age to donate with parental consent. So when we go to our high schools and high school kids coming into our donor centers, we ask that they bring a written consent from their parent that they are allowed to donate. At the age of 17, that consent is no longer necessary. And then they can donate throughout their lifetime as long as they remain healthy. We don't have an upper age limit, but we do, as donors are getting a little bit older, we want to make sure that they are, letting their physicians know that they're continuing to donate, and we assess their health with each of their donations.
When we are talking about specific factors, can those change very much over time? Or if somebody has been denied or deferred because of a physical condition, should they seriously think of not ever attempting again? Or does it make sense to return and see if some of those issues have, in a sense, receded?
As we learn more about blood donation and we learn more about transfusions to patients, the guidelines around who is eligible to donate and who isn't do change. So there are things years past. So we were talking a little bit earlier about low blood count, and somebody 10 years ago might have told, you can't donate today because you have a low blood count, and they don't get a good explanation behind it, and they leave feeling that they can never donate again. And and that's that is untrue. So I would encourage anybody that has been asked to not donate on a specific time to check back in on a regular basis to see if they are eligible to donate. And in fact, we have a couple of changes that the Food and Drug Administration is looking at right now that, you know, relate to different conditions. And so they're always going back and reevaluating.
At this point in the interview, we're going to listen to a conversation that I recorded a couple of days ago with a Carthage student, and it's related to the topic that we are discussing at the moment, namely, who is eligible to donate blood. I'm spending the next few minutes of the morning show talking with Sean Kelly, who is a senior at Carthage College, music theater major there. Theater major also?
Music theater.
Former voice student of mine, someone I know very well. I happen to also be a Facebook friend of Sean's, and so that's how I became aware of something which happened with Sean recently during a blood drive that was carried out at Carthage College. And I've asked Sean to recount exactly what happened when he and a number of his schoolmates went to donate blood in this recent blood drive at Carthage, which he believes was under the auspices of the American Red Cross. So, Sean, tell us what happened when you and your friends showed up to, you thought, donate blood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it was a regular Monday morning. I knew about this blood drive for weeks, and I was very excited to donate. So a bunch of my friends went, and we got in line, and we got in the system, and right when I was about to donate blood, they started asking me a series of questions that I thought were inappropriate, and I was very appalled to find out that when they were asking questions such as, have you ever participated in prostitution? Have you ever had to pay for sex? Have you ever used drugs with needles? And then the final question was, have you ever had sex with a man since 1984? And, you know, that was the start of the AIDS epidemic. And I understand, you know, through that area, you know, the 80s and 90s, but never in 2016 did I think I was going to be asked a question like that. And I am a gay man, and I have no problem speaking about that. But this question really took me by surprise. I
just wanted to ask, Sean, as they were asking these other questions, and I think a lot of times, even if you've donated blood, you don't necessarily even think very seriously about those kind of questions. But even as they were asking those questions, did you have any sense that those questions would ultimately lead to some question about your own sexual orientation, or did you not see that coming until the moment that that question was asked?
Yeah, it kind of just came out of left field. Like, it really just, it made me sick to my stomach because, you know, after just coming out of the closet a few years ago and then having to feel like if I really wanted to donate blood, I would have to lie. Like, I am a human being. I've had a boyfriend. I've had relationships. And it has happened before, and so have, you know, many other people. And I felt at that moment I would have to lie or I'd have to tell the truth and something bad would happen. And so I did. I did tell the truth, and I knew immediately. I saw it in this woman's face, and she told me, she's like, then she, after she asked me this question, and I said yes, she asked me another series of questions, like, when did this happen? How many times did this happen? Can you give me specific dates? And then that's when I felt a huge violation of privacy. But they were required. They were scripted. These workers were scripted to say these things to each potential donator. And then I knew at that point I was done, and I didn't want to be here anymore.
Mm. Was this done politely?
You know, it was done politely, and I could see it in this woman's face when I told her the truth. She told me, I'm very sorry, but you will be deferred. I don't necessarily agree with this, but...
She said that?
Yes.
Huh.
So I felt comfort in knowing that at least another person understood how uncomfortable I may have been or that this wasn't right. And she apologized, but she said she had to go through what she was required to say to each person.
Right. I know that you have with you what specifically the FDA regulation is. And you were telling me before we began recording that this is actually a regulation that has been recently revised.
Yes. So in the past year or two, the FDA, there's been a lot of uprising from the gay community and just from a lot of people who don't think this rule is correct. And the FDA proposed to change this, and the change was a man who has had sex with a man in the last year will be deferred, but before that, it'll be okay. So if you haven't had sex in the last year, you're fine. And, you know, this is a step in the right direction, but it's still very discriminatory towards our community. It pretty much says that people, that gay men who are married to each other, are in monogamous relationships, they cannot, you know, participate in sex for a whole year before they want to give blood. And whether they have HIV or not, you know, most of the gay community doesn't have HIV, and so it discludes a whole community from doing what they think is right, you know, donating blood, saving a life. Hmm. And that's really upsetting.
Yeah. If you were so empowered, how would you change this practice? I mean, would you not have any such question whatsoever asked, or should the question be different and phrased in such a way that would allow for instance, somebody in a monogamous relationship engaging in protected sex to be part of this? Or does the whole notion of going anywhere near these questions, is that just so offensive that you just don't want to go there at all?
Well, it is a very serious thing when you're donating blood, because you want to make sure, you know, that the donor is very clean, you know, that doesn't have HIV or some of these other diseases that can be transmitted through the blood. It's a very serious thing. And I think I've been thinking about this a lot. If HIV is the problem with the gay community, that's what raises all the red flags. If the community can be tested before giving blood, and if it comes back with, you know, a negative result, then I don't think there should be any stopping this person from giving blood.
So if you were able to demonstrate somehow, I was just tested,
right.
and
with maybe paperwork, I don't mind being asked these questions, but once I answered that first question and a bunch of other really personal questions about dates and when and who, like, I just felt like that was way too far and very unnecessary.
Right.
I think.
I wonder if you would just say a quick word about what happened in the aftermath of it, in terms of, for instance, the friends you were with, and also what happened once you shared this understandably upsetting experience with a wider swath of friends via Facebook.
Yeah, so leaving the donation site, I was just so sick to my stomach. I'm not a person who breaks down in tears, but I was just so angered, and I knew I needed to do something. And so I was like, I'm not going to get this anger out until, you know, I share it with my Facebook friends and my family. I called my parents up right away. I posted a status on Facebook, which got a lot of likes and a lot of responses. That made me feel a lot better, you know, that I wasn't alone and other people have experienced the same things in my situation. And then people were, you know, raising their voices and saying that I needed to do something. So I'm very thankful that you brought me here today to speak about this.
I appreciate your candor, Sean, and your willingness to offer this up. Sean Kelly, a senior at Carthage College. Thanks, Sean.
Thank you.
Okay, so now we are back with Linda Gruber, Director of Donor Services for the Blood Center of Wisconsin. And so, Linda Gruber, maybe you can offer some further clarification on what this student from Carthage has shared about what the current FDA regulations are regarding somebody who happens to be gay and whether or not it is possible for them to donate blood.
So it's interesting that the way that we talk about this is not anybody's, whether they're gay or whether they're not. It really is, are there behaviors or are there situations that a person is exposed to, and this is of any gender, that could potentially put a risk to the patient for the transmission of infectious diseases. So when we are talking about asking particular questions that are related to transfusion-transmitted diseases, I know that's a big word, but it really it applies to all genders. And the FDA has, over the years, as I talked earlier about learning more about transfusion transmission and how our testing has become much better to detect those types of diseases or viruses that can be transmitted by blood, the process of identifying where a risk is has also changed. So I want to make sure that when we're looking at the questions that we're asking our donors, we ask every donor, and the exclusion is really not based on their preferences as much as it is on a risk behavior that maybe was identified years ago. And that is the hardest part of the questionnaire, because you are asking people that, for instance, if you've traveled to a country that has a risk of malaria, you have to wait a year when you come back to make sure that you haven't been exposed and develop a malaria before you are eligible to donate. So we try very hard to make sure that this isn't a broad category, but a very specific questionnaire to determine that risk of exposure to a virus or a disease that can be transmitted by blood.
I know the regulation is a bit different than it originally was. How much do these regulations tend to change over time?
It's interesting that the regulations, again, change as we learn more about the transmission and we have different testing that we do. This one that we're talking about in particular has been recently updated, and it was updated in December of 2015, and that was based on information and studies and data that had been submitted to the FDA that they have reviewed over a course of probably 10 to 15 years before they changed that regulation. Some other regulations change more frequently, but when we're talking about that risk behavior, it takes them a long time to make sure that they are making the right decision for the patients out in the community.
We have not yet talked about different blood types, and I am a little foggy on this myself, but I know that there is at least one blood type that is especially valuable for a place like the Blood Center of Wisconsin. Can you just clarify that?
So all blood types are valuable.
Right, I should.
You are right. There is, we particularly are calling on our O-neg donors on a very regular basis. And our O-negative donors are what we call a universal red blood cell donor. So when an O-negative donor comes in to donate, that unit of blood that they have donated, again, separated into red blood cells and into plasma, those red blood cells can go to any patient. So they are used at a much higher rate because we use them in emergency situations. They use them on Flight for Life. You know, any time that you have a patient that has an immediate need for a transfusion, that's the first thing they're going to put their hand out and grab in order to save that patient's life. So we use in the, you know, out in the hospitals, that O negative blood, and the use of that blood is a little bit higher than some of the others just because of those overall conditions. So we do go to our O negative blood donors on a much more frequent basis than some of our others.
Right. And, of course, they're well versed in this whole matter of blood donation,
yeah.
Of course, by now.
Absolutely.
If there are people who want more information about blood donation in general and specifically the Blood Center of Wisconsin, can you direct them to a website or other resources?
Certainly. So we do have a website, and let me pull that up real quick, and I should have that right at the top of my mind, and I don't. But it is www.bcw.edu.
So BCW for Blood Center of Wisconsin, .edu. Great.
Yeah, EDU for education. And it has, it talks about all of the other branches of the blood center. So we aren't, Blood Center of Wisconsin is not just blood center. There is also diagnostic labs and the Medical Sciences Institute and the organ procurement operations and the tissues. So there's a lot of great information on that website, including blood donation.
Linda Gruber, Director of Donor Services for the Blood Center of Wisconsin, thank you so much for joining me.
Greg, thank you so much for your time.
To finish out today's morning show, I'm delighted to welcome back to the program Lisa Kornetsky, who is professor of theater at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside and the director of their production of a 19th century Russian comic classic called The Government Inspector by Nikolai Gogol. Ahead of us talking specifically about the play, which is being performed this weekend and the next, I asked Professor Kornetsky to explain how a typical theater season at UW-Parkside is put together.
We have a formula of sorts. We do a musical every other year. We usually do a Shakespeare each year. But we try to do a play out of the canon, a classic play that people may have seen, will have heard of, but that will really also expose our students to different styles and our audiences to different styles and different genres. For me, I just really, I bring to the table the things that I'm most interested in doing, and then we sit and we talk about what opportunities this provides for our students and our designers, you know, our actors and our designers. So sometimes it comes from me, and I must admit I push pretty hard for the things that I want to do, and sometimes it comes collectively from the group. This particular play, I do want to say, I wanted to do something. I wanted to do a comedy. I wanted to do a big, broad farce because that's a style that it's difficult. It's and now that I'm immersed in it, I will say it's particularly difficult because it's not a necessarily intellectual comedy, and it involves a lot of vocal and physical characterizations, along with, of course, comic timing and all of that. So I wanted to do something in that style. And I knew The Government Inspector, although I had never read it. And I thought, well, I should look at this play. And I read the original by Gogol, and I thought, well, this is okay, but maybe it doesn't speak to us, which is probably why people have heard of it, but it isn't done very often. And then I remembered that I had seen a production of The Government Inspector at the Milwaukee Repertory Theater in, you know, maybe 8 years ago, and went back and found my program, I saved them all, and realized that it was an adaptation by Jeffrey Hatcher, who's a contemporary playwright and adapter, someone I think who worked with Carthage College in the last couple of years on one of their original pieces. And I remembered how much fun that show was. And I got that adaptation and read it, and I thought, this is the play. This is the one we're going to do. So I think it's the best of both worlds. It's a classic play that has all of those components, but it's a contemporary adaptation that brings a contemporary sensibility to the play.
As you're talking about it, and especially as you're talking about your experience of reading the original, I'm reminded of a work I've been involved in at Carthage for our opera workshop, Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro, which I think is a really good example of a work that, I mean, is even older than Gogol's play, and is still hilariously funny. And it, I mean, it's not funny in that kind of, I bet that was funny 250 years ago kind of way. But I mean, funny now, laugh out loud funny now. But I think there are very few works like that. I mean, comedy in some ways tends not to travel over the centuries particularly well. And I wonder, as we think about this play and then about its adaption, is it kind of a case of that of what was once funny isn't still funny in the same way, or are there other issues here?
Well, I would say from what I know, and I have to admit that I haven't done a tremendous amount of research on the original play, but what I know about Gogol and what I know about this play is that it was very much rooted in statements that he was making about the government and the bureaucracy of his time. You know, that 19th century, this play was written in 1836 under the rule of Tsar Nicholas I, who was a real autocratic ruler, and dissension wasn't permitted, criticizing the government wasn't permitted. So I think a lot of what's in the original play, it transcends its time, kind of, you know, if that makes sense. I think the conventions of comedy that are in that play mistaken identity, you know, farces, you know, big physical comedy, that certainly transcends its time. But this contemporary adaptation really allows us to take that framework, that original story and those characters, and bring those same themes to today and kind of remind us of why the premise is still funny, but allows us to understand it within the comic sensibilities that we have today, which are probably quite different than what they were in 19th century Russia.
Right. Well, let's start with the essential components of the original story, and then maybe you can explain what Jeffrey Hatcher has exactly done with that in terms of the changes he's made, or if in any sense it is updated or transplanted, or just what he's done with that. But what's the heart of the original story?
Okay, so the story is really pretty simple, although whenever I try to explain a plot of a story, I'm not necessarily very good at it. But as I said, the play was written in 1836, and it takes place in a provincial Russian town of that period. The town is run by a mayor, and he has a number of people who help him to run the town, a school principal, a hospital director, a police chief, a postmaster, his family. And the focus is on this group of individuals who run this little village with bribery, corruption, greed, and they kind of make things work by supplanting other people's rights and greasing their palms. And it seems to work fairly well for them. Of course, there's their undercurrent. We see little glimpses of the fact that it doesn't necessarily work as well for the merchant class, for the servants or the serfs who live in that community. The mayor receives a letter from his brother-in-law, which indicates that there is a government inspector from the capital who's coming to see what they're doing. And then there is an assumption through some series of factors that there is someone staying at the inn who actually is that government inspector and has been there incognito for a week. So there is this character. He's a young man. He is kind of a gambler, and he sees a lot of women. He's lost all of his money. He's in great debt at this inn. The mayor thinks he's the government inspector, and that all of the comedy ensues from there, from that sort of mistaken identity premise.
Now, does the mayor know all of this other stuff? I mean, that he's in debt to the hotel and all that?
When the two of them first meet, there's a wonderful scene where Lestikov, the young man, is thinking the mayor is there to arrest him.
Ah.
And the mayor is thinking that when he's talking about money, he wants him to give him money. So everybody is constantly giving Lestikov money, which makes Lestikov very happy. So he decides to stay, and they wine him and dine him. They get him drunk so that he will reveal what he knows. And it ensues from there.
Gotcha. So Jeffrey Hatcher's treatment of it then, what has he done? Has he transplanted it, updated it, abridged it?
He hasn't transplanted it, and he hasn't abridged it. But what he's done is he's made it much wittier, first of all. He's added a little bit of just a little spark of sexual innuendo, you know, which I think is the kind of thing that contemporary audiences are used to in comedy. He's made it broader. The original has a lot of comedy that would be, this goes to your last question, the character names, the Russian character names, are indicative of the personalities of the characters. And of course, we're not going to understand what those Russian idiomatic phrases are. So he does that same sort of character development through the way that people talk and the lines that they say. I'm going to read a quote because I love this, and this is something that our dramaturg found on Jeffrey Hatcher talking on adapting the play, and I think it's just really interesting because he has adapted Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Cousin Bet, a number of classic novels and plays, and this is what he had to say. A playwright friend of mine says the three best things in life are sex, food, and rewriting someone else's play. An adapter of someone else's play gets a modified version of that particular fission, not as scholarly or precise as a translator, not as free and original as the author himself. Writing an adaptation is like a game of telephone. Someone whispers a story to someone else, who in turn whispers it to someone else, etc. The fun is finding out if the story you get at the end matched the story you started with the beginning.
Mm.
So I think he talks about massaging the text and bringing new things to it. The text really takes a lot of the historic pieces out of it. It's still set in this location, but it's very loosely set. And the language is very contemporary, so it has this sort of dual feeling, which I love in a play, where, you know, it's not historically rooted in a way that makes us think, oh, here, we're going to watch a play about Russia in the 19th century. We're watching a play that takes place in this era, in this time, and the costumes reflect that, but the world view is pretty contemporary.
Mm. So the even down to the language itself is not particularly antiquated then?
No, not at all. Not at all. And I think that's the thing that he does best, you know, the wit of the language. And he creates some situations that are not in the original text between characters. So he takes this, the sort of framework and the suggestion of what's happening throughout the play, and he goes into more depth in sections that allow us to find, I think, a greater sense of comedy of character than we do in the original.
Hmm. How large a cast are we talking about?
15 people, okay, playing 19 roles.
Wow, pretty significant number of people on the stage. And is this going on the main stage at Parkside?
This is the only show this year that we've done on the main stage. It is on the main stage. We've done something a little differently. I think in every time I do a show on the main stage, I'm concerned about the, even though we have a wonderful space, the lack of intimacy in a large house. So we've both moved it forward, so we're bringing the play to the audience, but we've also built onto our orchestra pit. So we actually have some seats that are right in the orchestra pit, so a couple of rows. So we've also brought the audience closer, and we're really working very hard to sell tickets, you know, to really focus on the center of the house. This is a kind of play that has a lot of asides, and that's something else that Jeffrey Hatcher has done, and that's certainly not a contemporary device, but it's not really existing in Gogol's original play. And we have characters who are constantly talking to the audience, reflecting on, you know, they're in the middle of a conversation, they turn to the audience and say something to the effect of, you know, what should I do?
Yeah,
or
right.
They point to someone and say, you're to blame. You know, so there's that interaction, breaking of the fourth wall and then putting it back up and breaking it again.
Mm.
So it's really perfect for the main stage.
Yeah, that sounds like a great match. Is there anything else about the production itself that is in any way out of the ordinary?
Yeah, we have had a lot of fun with this production, coming up with a concept that we thought would be really creative and fun for our designers, our actors, and our audiences. So I hope that people will enjoy it. When we started the process, Keith Harris, who is our theater manager and designs for us, is a wonderful designer, and I've worked with him, for off and on for 30 years.
Mm.
So we have a nice way of communicating. We started discussing this play in the summer, and I came in with my preliminary ideas, which really had to do with sort of the idea of cartoons, that these characters are, I would describe these characters as somewhat unique in comedy, because in most comedy, you have a heroic character. You have someone who comes in. You have a good guy who comes in and kind of saves the day, makes things right. In this play, everybody's kind of the same, although they have their own behavioral quirks. But everyone is out for themselves. These characters are not self-reflective. They don't have a lot of positive ways of looking at the community that they're in. So they're all out for themselves. So they're kind of these cartoon characters who are really emblematic of a lot of human behavior.
Mm.
So I came in with this idea of cartoons. I brought in some renderings from another play from the 19th century, which I love, which really has these larger-than-life, almost, you know, Weebles kind of characters. Mm. And Keith looked at that, and Misty Bradford, our costume designer, looked at that. And then we had a series of conversations talking about, you know, looking at visual representations of Russian posters, of Russian villages, trying to get a sense of what did Russia look like in this period, what was some of the artwork, even going into the 20th century, looking at sort of the formalism of Russian propaganda posters and the kind of line and shape and form that was there. We talked about the game Jenga, and that was a big transition for us in developing a concept. And the game Jenga, if you've ever played it, where you have these these different pieces, and you keep removing pieces until the structure falls apart. From there, we started to talk about children's blocks, and that's what brought us to the concept we have. So when you walk into the theater, you see a false proscenium that is just, I wish we were on TV so I could show the visuals, but it's a false proscenium that is made up of blocks. So it is this kind of structure that doesn't seem like it could possibly stay up. It's all kind of wonky and crooked, but it's solid enough to be stable. But there's always this feeling that something could fall, something could come apart. And so that seemed to be a nice metaphor for this world where people have pieced together what they need to run this town. But at any moment, a government inspector could arrive and everything could fall apart. And we talked a lot about this idea of, you know, persona and, you know, what people say they're doing versus what they are doing. So this idea in theater that we talk about all the time of the mask. And that developed into an idea for the costumes, which I just, and the makeup, which I just love. The costumes, Misty Bradford came up with this really creative idea. So we have the actors all in a period costume that is dirty and distressed and drab. But over that, there's a secondary costume, and it's almost like a paper doll with the tab. So the front is complete. But when they turn around or when they raise their arms, the under costume shows. So we have this drab, dirty underneath. And on top are these incredibly colorful, larger-than-life costumes that are filled with all kinds of decoration, but are also made out of foam. And they are made out of foam that is the same foam that you find on the roof of your car. So it is an inexpensive material to purchase, and you can dye it, you can hot glue it, you can staple it, you can sew it. So it's very easy to work with, and it's very versatile. So all of those costumes are constructed, but we were able to do that with people who, you know, some of our students who don't have a lot of skills. The design is very complex. And there's a lot to do, but the execution is fairly easy, as I understand it. So we have this sort of twofold costumes. And because it's a larger-than-life play, there are characters who are indicated to be, for instance, there's a pregnant character. There are characters who are always referred to as being very fat. So there's a lot of padding. And for instance, one way that we've approached this, when Misty said to me, so this pregnant character, how pregnant is she? And I thought about it, and I said, 15 months. So she is
very pregnant.
Huge. Yeah. And so, you know, the costumes really accommodate that sort of larger than life. And if you want to think of, they're just fun to look at. If you want to think about it, there's a message behind that. The makeup is also somewhat like a mask. And we have these foam pieces. The wigs are part hair, the actor's own hair, with foam curls, foam mustaches, painted facial hair, just a lot of very big, broad choices. It's very colorful. And again, it's that sort of larger than life. The line and form are Russian from the period, but the rest of it feels pretty timeless. Yeah. And it's very colorful. The set is very colorful.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people will just enjoy the visual feast, and then you get to this wonderful comedy. It's all kinds of things to enjoy. Real quickly, so was it a tough sell to get your students excited about doing a play like this? I mean, when they hear that it's from Russia in 1837, is that initially at least a little bit of a turnoff?
I don't think so. Our students really weren't familiar with it. They hadn't read it. But I think when we made the play available to students over the summer and students read it, they loved it. I mean, it's the kind of play that actually is a great joy to read, which is not always the case with plays because they're not meant to be read.
Right.
But I think the students were very excited, and a lot of them really loved the fact that they would have an opportunity to do something really physical in terms of the comedy.
Wow. It sounds cool. So it's this weekend and next weekend. Give us the specifics.
Okay. So it opens tonight, Friday night, the 29th. It runs the 29th and 30th at 7:30. And then May 6th, 7th, and 8th, I'm sorry, 5th, 6th, and 7th at 7:30 with a matinee on the 6th at 10 a.m.
Very good. Lisa Konecki, the director of this production of The Government Inspector by Nikolai Gogol as reimagined by Jeffrey Hatcher. Sounds like a wonderful, fun, stimulating night at the theater.
I think people will enjoy themselves.
Lisa Konecki, professor of theater at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Great to talk with you again. Thanks for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you.
Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Monday on The Morning Show, I look forward to welcoming back into the studios Kate Jerome, who is